Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by the editor and columnist Simon Jenkins. Simon might be the grandest of British journalism grandees. Knighted for services to the industry in 2004, he edited the London Evening Standard and The Times, covered politics for The Economist, and founded the Sunday Times book pages. Now known for his views on politics and culture as a columnist at The Guardian, he has also held public appointments at British Rail, English Heritage, and was a member of the Millennium Commission. Having recently ended his six-year term as chairman of the National Trust, he has written more than 15 books on topics as diverse as English churches, Thatcher, and of course, the media. Simon, thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
Did you always want to be a journalist? How did you get started?
I think I wanted to be a politician. I know very few journalists didn't really want to be a politician somewhere deep down inside them. But I started journalism at the University at Oxford. I did a totally conventional educational sort of story doing PPE at Oxford. That's philosophy, politics and economics. Mm. I worked on Charwell. I left, went into academia, was an academic for about two or three years. But I craved journalism. Went into journalism, was quite political. I mean, I got involved in sort of left-wing Tory pressure groups and so on. But all the time, I just thought politics is boring compared to journalism. And it was just journalism that sort of sucked me in.
How young were you when you got the journalism bug? I mean, did you always want to be a journalist ever since you were a kid?
No, I think my father was an academic. I think I probably thought I was going to be occupying that sort of middle ground between academia and writing and politics and journalism. I mean, that's a fairly conventional, I may say, sort of London upbringing. I'm a total Londoner. I was always fascinated by the buzz of public affairs. I never thought I was a very good politician. I didn't like speaking in public then, and I was very nervous of speaking. So I preferred the anonymity or the backroom job of being a journalist.
When you took your first step into journalism, as it were, how ambitious were you? I mean, did you know that you wanted to be editor of The Standard or The Times? Did you think that that was your destiny? Or were you just kind of saying, let's see where the music takes us?
I think probably at the beginning, I did see journalism as a vehicle into politics, as a way into politics. An awful lot of people of my generation went into politics from journalism. And I think I probably saw it that way. It didn't help. I didn't really know what party I supported. But I think probably it was simply I saw lots of my friends drifting off into politics and having a ghastly time of it while I was doing better and better or getting better and better jobs in journalism. And I just found it more attractive in every way. I mean, you're more uninhibited. You weren't constrained by party disciplines and loyalties.
The whips constantly wanting you to do this and that.
Exactly. And frankly, the people were more interesting. And I went straight into, and I did various odd jobs like everybody does at the beginning. I sort of almost interned at Country Life magazine, much to my embarrassment, to my friend's amusement. Then I worked for the Times Educational Supplement as a trainee for the Times. But my big break was going to the Evening Standard. And I was there in 68 in very, very exciting times. And that was it. I mean, I was hooked.
So how did you come to start at The Standard then? How did that opportunity open up for you?
I am acutely aware that journalism is basically about contact. London journalism is about contact. It's not satisfactory. It was someone meeting me somewhere, saying, I gather there's a job going here, mentioning me to the editor of the Evening Standard.
Who was the editor then?
Charles Winter, the great Charles Winter, one of the great, I say, talent spotters. But it was not a good system, frankly. And interesting, the one people who were against it were the trade union. I mean, the union, National Union of Journalists, was quite strict in those days and very quite powerful. And I had to make my peace with them, and that wasn't necessarily very easy.
So they opposed your personal appointment at the start?
To be fair, they opposed it, but they said, look, you know, he's not trained yet. He hasn't done 2 years or anything, and this is a national paper, the Evening Standard. You've got to prove yourself. I mean, they made me go off and learn shorthand. I remember that. And I'm jolly glad they did. I mean, sooner or later, it was all right. But, I mean, there was that sort of hiccup. And I'm not sure I thought it was a bad thing either. I mean, I got the point.
Charles must have been quite a talent spot if he was prepared to hire you, given that you hadn't completed the training, as it were. He must have been impressed with what you'd done at the TES and maybe even Country Life.
I don't think Country Life. I mean,
how did it come about then?
Fascinating though that was. I mean, that was my trying to get a job at the TES, and the editor there saying, I haven't got a job, but my friend who's the editor of Country Life has got one. I mean,
it's always
just
the way.
It was just like that.
It's still like that now.
It is more like that now. I mean, at least now they're journalism schools and there's their formal traineeship programs. But in those days, it was much more casual. Although, when I tried to get a job on The Times, the then home editor of The Times refused to take people who hadn't been in the provinces. John Young. He was absolutely adamant. I'm not taking you sort of smart alecks from Times Educational Supplement or wherever. I take people who've been on the Yorkshire Post. So go and work on the Yorkshire Post. He was blunt like that. So I didn't get a job on the Times, which I wanted. Standard was much more casual. It was very much then, to a certain extent still is, a part of London life. London was not the city it is now. But it was a much smaller place. And the Standard was absolutely at the hub of it. Mm. I mean, any new restaurant opened, you're all invited. You know, we were kind of a gang. And the people who were there at the time, you know, they stuck with it. I mean, they were good people.
Do you look back fondly of your years at the Standard then?
Well, I mean, I was at the Standard for some years. Then I...
How many years were you there?
Well, I joined the Standard, I think, in 68. Then I was offered a job on the Sunday Times. And I'd been features editor of the Standard. I was offered a job on the Sunday Times by Harry Evans. I went to edit Insight at the Sunday Times. I was there for a year and a half. It was not a happy period. Sunday Times under Harry Evans is always regarded as one of the greats of journalistic golden ages.
And I met Harry many times. In fact, we gave him an award at the Media Society for services to journalism, all the stuff he did on thalidomide and all kinds of things. He was an amazing editor.
Ask people who served with him. He was an amazing editor. He was a courageous editor.
But
he had money to spend, which was a great advantage in an editor. To have money to spend and the confidence of your employers, the Thompsons then. And Harry ran these great campaigns, which he was famous for, no doubt about it. And they became sort of part of the zeitgeist. He had a very good lawyer. I mean, he had good people around him. But he was hopelessly overstaffed. And the effect of overstaffing is always demoralizing. Never a good thing for a paper to be overstaffed. You had features, you probably had 15 or 16 features writers who just never got into the paper. I mean, they were 3 months with nothing in the paper. Good people. And Harry just did
compare that now to a newsroom that might have three people in it total.
It's difficult to remember back. I mean, these were people living well on expenses, writing books. I mean, Insight wrote two books when I was there, I think. Yeah, we worked quite hard. But it was so overstaffed that everybody was fighting all the time for space. And Harry was sort of wonderfully above it. He was a great guy. He gave me a great break. I'm not going to complain. I've remained friends with him since. But I learned from that having lots of good people on your paper is a good thing if you've got space for them. But Sunday papers are rarely happy places. Sunday papers are once a week. You've got a full staff with one paper a week to get your stuff into. And when I went from there back to the Standard or onto the regular daily papers, it was like liberation. You had a paper to fill every day, and that was exciting.
Would you ever go back to a Sunday paper then? I mean,
well, I've been to the Sunday. I think I've worked for the Sunday Times four times, certainly three. I lose track. But then as a columnist, which is much totally different. I mean, you actually have a straight column to write. The most important thing is every journalist knows you've got allotted space. When you've got allotted space to fill, you're a happy man.
So just come back to your time at the Sunday Times then. So it was, I'm flabbergasted that you said that the paper was overstaffed, because that is just something that my peers and I would never even be able to comprehend in today's media environment. But what came next, and were your ambitions started to kind of form at this point that you wanted the editorship? I mean, where did you think your career was heading at this point? Were you still wanting to end up in politics?
No, I'd given that one up. We're in 74, 75, and then Charles went to ask me come back as deputy editor of the Standard, and I sensed at the time he was thinking of retiring. I didn't know that, but I mean, and I wasn't. I just wasn't terribly happy at the Sunday Times, I have to admit. The deputy editorship of the Evening Standard was just wonderful. It was a very, very exciting time, and I went back for a year as deputy editor, and that was 76. Deputy editor is another job I don't cherish.
Yes, like vice president.
It's like vice president. It's exactly what it's like. I mean, you do the Sunday shift. I mean, you do the late shift. You're the mug.
Yeah, it's all downside and no upside, is it? Because you still get to have tea with the Queen.
You don't know what that's worth. No, you're quite right. I was that for a year, and then I became editor of the Evening Standard, and that was
a joyous moment for you. That's it. I've arrived.
Yeah. I mean, I was 32. I mean, it was amazing, frankly. I was too young. I was too young. These were days. It's very difficult to cast back to those days. These were the days when newspapers were run by two people, the proprietor and the trade unions. And the editor was sort of almost negotiating between these two factors. And it was usually hell, largely because of the unions. I mean, they made your life really difficult. And on evening paper, you needed new editions all the time. You know, bombs were going off. This was happening. That was happening. Stop the presses. Start a new edition. okay, boss, that's 100 quid each. Straight like that. I mean, complete blackmail. And that was relentless. It was all the time. And we were making lots of money out of classified advertising, and we were losing it all downstairs to the unions. And they were difficult times, and it culminated in the attempt to sell the Evening Standard to the Evening News. And that battle, basically to save the Standard, dominated my career at the Evening Standard. They tried to merge it with Evening News. I was for about a week out of a job. Then we found another buyer. We fought back. Charles Winter was, you know, he was upstairs. You know what he was. He had some executive job at the Express newspapers. But the Express Group under Jocelyn Stevens tried to flog off the Standard. And the Evening News would have been the only paper in London. It would have been the Evening News, not the Evening Standard. And we saved that. And it was great fun. I mean, if you're very young and fighting, it was, and the staff were with you, and you had meetings in the office and all these sorts of things.
Was it a kind of real us and them mentality amongst the editorial staff as well? Did they have a lot of kind of animosity toward the unions? Did they feel that their business and their livelihood was being put at risk because of the...
It wasn't the unions, to be fair. It really wasn't. No, I mean, the unions were just the same everywhere. I mean, the unions, you know, they were dominating Fleet Street. And, you know, this was hot metal. I mean, these were the days when you went downstairs, you know, with the edition, and you smelt the linotype machine. You smelt the caseworkers. I mean, this was hot metal. Mm. There were foundries. There was molten metal flowing around the printing room.
When the phrase "off stone" actually meant something,
and you heard the banging out. All, I mean, it was there was no way. I'm not a romantic. You know, those days were not good days in many ways, but it was very, very exciting. In the loft of the Evening Standard, there was the pigeon loft for the football results. I mean, they stopped using pigeons to come in from the London football grounds because they couldn't get to a telephone. I mean. They used pigeons to get them.
That is insane.
In my lifetime. And downstairs there was the whole print floor, and then in the basement there were the great machines, and you heard them rumbling. You heard them starting up. Once they rumbled, you knew you'd miss the edition. Quite unlike anything else.
So in a sense, although you were editor of the Standard, you didn't have much time for actually editing it because you were too busy trying to find a buyer and negotiating with the unions and spinning various plates and putting out lots of different fires.
It was true. And we staved off the sale to Rothermere and the Daily Mail and the Evening News. A whole series of weirdos tried to buy the Evening Standard. I mean, Olga Detterding, Jimmy Goldsmith, I mean, all these people tried to buy it. We ended up with Victor Matthews of the Trafalgar House Group. We bought the whole group. Jocelyn Stevens, who was effectively the salesman on behalf of the Aitken family, sold it to them. And then Trafalgar House gave Victor Matthews the Evening Standard and the Daily Express as a sort of toy to play with.
Incredible.
He was a complete nightmare. He's a builder. He was nothing against him personally, but he had no idea what he was doing.
Mm.
And that was terrible. And I lasted that about 6 months or a year. And they got rid of me, and Charles Winter took over temporarily. So it ended in sorts of tears.
Mm.
But it was a very exciting and exhilarating time. And I, in a funny way, you can be too young as an editor. And I honestly think I was just too young.
We had Chris Blackhurst in that chair a few months ago, and he said there was many, you know, advantages of being the editor. But he said in many ways, being the editor is actually quite a lonely, quite an unhappy job. He said he was constantly having to deal with HR and legal issues, for which he might have had a, you know, half a page of A4 briefing or an afternoon's briefing, but he was completely ill-equipped to deal with some very highly strategic issues. But it fell under his purview because he was the editor.
Well, he was later. He didn't have to deal with the union. He didn't. I mean, but by the time he took it, he would have been an editor. I mean, it was, you know.
So he had it easy then.
He had it easy. I mean, these are people who operated a totally different code of conduct. They were interested in the chapel, the mystery, the Freemasonry, all these things that were going on down there. And they were only interested in the money. They had a kind of romantic attachment to the paper. But the fact that it was this, the Evening Standard, was really tangential. I mean, they had jobs elsewhere in Fleet Street. They were doing shifts everywhere. They were rich men, many of them. They were doing well.
I'm not surprised if they're charging an extra 100 quid just to restart the presses.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Mm.
It's something, you know, I'm 40 years old, but I just can't imagine it. It's just a completely different world, isn't it?
It was a totally different world. And when I went on to edit the Times in totally different circumstances, and that was utterly unlike editing a hot metal paper.
You left the Standard editorship after 2 years. What came next?
I've always thought in life, always have your exit planned.
Yeah.
The Economist said, well, I'd like to come and be political editor. Again, it was someone I knew, but, you know, there we are.
Who was editor of The Economist at the time?
Andrew Knight.
Right.
He's very kind to me. I've always felt well towards people who've offered me jobs when I've needed one.
And it was the political beat, of course, which you were still interested in?
And I'd been writing editorials and so on, and I wrote a column for The Standard when I left. I could have gone on doing that, but I thought I'd break and do something else. The Economist was completely different. I mean, it was like going back to university. It was very cerebral.
Still is. I read The Economist. I think it's great at what it does, but it's a one-off.
It was fashioned in Knight's day, and it's really remained the same formula ever since. And it's very, very successful.
How long were you there for?
I was there until I went with Andrew Neil to the Sunday Times. And I went there in 79, and I think I went to the Sunday Times in 85, I think. So I was there for 5 years, and it was a good time. Frankly, it was fairly relaxed. I joined the British Rail Board, and I loved the railways. I was just fascinated by them, and I was doing other things as well. I've always sort of believed in journalists doing other things, and that's another story. Mm. But The Economist was a good place to work, and I did a lot of traveling. I covered South Africa. I wrote 2 or 3 books. I mean, it was sort of, I used to call it a rather upmarket monastery. but anyway, I was very happy there.
I mean, the phrase portfolio career is quite well known now, but it strikes me that even then you had a kind of portfolio career. As you said, you've got other interests, you joined the board of BRB, et cetera, et cetera. Was that something that was always important to you, to have a diversity of interests?
I don't know. I mean, I totally respect journalists who say you should not have anything to do with anything in any other world but journalism, and you're a reporter. I used to have great rows with a friend of mine who was dean of Columbia Journalism School about what a journalist really is. And Oz Elliott, a great man, and he gave this great commencement address. It was about that time. He showed it to me, and he said, "What do you think? What do you think?" You see, and this address was unbelievable. I mean, it was addressing the great sort of talents that coming out of the Columbia Journalism School. And he said, you are the unofficial legislator of America. You know, you're as important as senators and congressmen. You hold in your pen the future of the American Constitution. Without you, America decays and collapses. What do you think? So I said, I don't think anyone in Britain would believe a word you've just said. I said, what do you mean? I said, if journalists leave journalism school in Britain, they are told you're the lowest form of human life. You're the rats in the gutter. You're the scum. Your job is to to dish the dirt. Okay,
yes.
And they never think of themselves that way.
It's incredible the difference in culture.
It was a complete difference in journalistic culture, and it remains to a certain extent that today.
So tell us about you went to the Sunday Times with Andrew Neil, is that right? Was he editor then? Did he move with you to become editor?
Andrew went to edit the, I don't know how he got the job, he went to edit the Sunday Times, that was Murdoch, and he asked me to go, and I shortly afterwards went with him to write a column, quite straightforwardly, and it was the beginning of my career as an ordinary pucker columnist, and to found the book section, which he was just starting.
So this was a change then, wasn't it? From being a kind of journalist covering stories, you're now moving into commenting on them and being a columnist. Was that a deliberate change, or is it something you welcomed? Did you always want to do that?
I think something in me has always been a columnist. I read a column at Charwell. I read a column for the Evening Standard almost the whole time I was there, except when I was editing. I missed it when I was at The Economist. It's an anonymous place.
And it
really was. And there weren't even those sort of Badgett columns. So I really did miss it.
They didn't have a masthead, do they? I mean, they don't even say who the editor is, do they? You have to kind of Google it, I think. I think there's an email that once a week that says it comes from the desk of Zanny Minton Beddoes, but it doesn't actually say she wrote it. It's a strange culture, that.
Well, it was a strange culture. It was a formula that was basically evolved. And Andrew and maybe his predecessor, but it was the formula was simply of the digested writing, and you had a team of people who rewrote everything. It was very annoying to see your copy rewritten. It was very annoying for other people to see you rewriting their copy, and it all had this kind of spin to it, slightly knowing, slightly upmarket, but very well informed. And it was just intellectually seductive. And really, all I can say is it worked and works.
Absolutely. What works, works. Mm. So back to the Sunday Times then. So you're writing a column. I mean, clearly the Sunday Times is a huge seller, massively impactful. Mm. So that must have felt quite good at that point then, that you felt you had an audience and a platform to start to speak truth to power, as it were. And of course, and then you founded the book section as well.
Yes, I mean, it was a difficult time. I mean, the Wapping riots were still on. I mean, you went past, by then, some very jaded pickets.
Mm. How long did that last, the dispute?
It went on probably 2 years. I mean, it was I forget when they started. It was 83, 4. I think I went in 85.
It's one of my earliest memories, because I was 10, and I can remember I can remember scenes of pickets from Wapping being on the TV news and Frank Boff introducing them. So that just shows you to know how long ago it was. And it lasted 2 years.
I think it did, yeah. I'm going to be correct. I mean, I think it was a good 2 years. By the time I went there, the dispute was sort of over. Mm. Largely because the Electricians Union were in. But there were still pickets there. And they were very unpleasant. I got no sympathy for them at all. I mean, they were defending the indefensible. They were exceptionally rude to women. They were sort of foul-mouthed. And they were drunk. And they were being paid. It was not a nice thing to do.
But who's paying them? The union?
Yeah. Well, I have to say, they're not the union, the chapel.
Right.
I mean, you've got to understand that they were not sort of bona fide trade union pickets. They were chapel pickets. It was tough times, and Wapping was not a nice place to work and all that. But anyway, I mean, it was a good paper to be on. I thought Rupert was not a bad proprietor to work for. When we started the book section, I always remember him saying, you know, I want a book section like the New York Times. I can't stand the fact we haven't got a New York Times book section. I want a New York Times book section. I said, you know, right, Rupert, you know, that's a lot of money. I mean, they haven't got no ads. Mm. And that's 32 pages. I want 32 pages. And I said, well, I don't think your staff in London take that view. And he said, oh, well, they will. And I always remember, you know, you started with 32 pages. Next week, 24 pages. Fighting. Next week, 16 pages. Every week I had to go to Rupert. Rupert would overrule the management. And eventually they knew you'd run out of steam. So it came down to 16, I think, eventually. But it was a very, very good
prolific section, and lasted many years.
Yes, there were 30 reviews. It was really as substantial as the TLS, or as good in its coverage as the TLS. But they weren't as long, obviously. They were very good reviewers. I mean, it was bloody good.
How did it work in terms of your autonomy then? Because you were the editor of a section. How big an influence was Andrew on that section? And clearly, obviously, Rupert had a few things to say about it as well.
Rupert didn't, except when his wife wrote a novel. That I will not forget.
Were you gently lent upon to give it a favourable review?
He was very good at it. He could see our potential embarrassment.
Because he is a newspaper man, isn't
Rupert,
exactly. At the end of the day.
Rupert was always a newspaper man. I mean, he was not easy to work for. You come on to that. But, I mean, he was a newspaper man to his fingertips, as was Andrew. No, it was a good time. I mean, you know, Andrew, you know, what's the lead review? Yeah, I mean, you know, he and I just thought alike, because it wasn't any problem. And I was quite close to him. I mean, I was part of the team. So, no, those were happy days.
What do you think the qualities that make a good newspaper proprietor are? I mean, clearly a limitless pot of cash and a dedication to editorial independence at all costs, and then someone who never gets involved and occasionally gives you a call from their yacht. I mean, or do you want someone more hands-on, that's like, for example, Rupert was?
It is impossible to answer the question. Every single newspaper proprietor is different. They're all usually in it for something. It's no good pretending they're not in it for something. Most of them are in it for glory. They want some sort of access, some sort of fame, some sort of power. There's something in their makeup that wants to be a newspaper proprietor. I cannot understand, I have to say, the Barclay brothers at the moment.
They're completely anonymous.
They profess to be anonymous. They're shy of publicity and everything. What the hell are they running the Telegraph for?
Can you tell us?
I don't know. I asked them once. They didn't have a reply. Whereas most people, you know, I mean, you know, they've got the Rothermere's who are really ancestral owners, as was Aitken. I mean, when Max Aitken ran it, he was just a rather sad figure, really. He was doing it out of honour to his father, really. He wouldn't even take his father's title. You know, he felt so strongly. In Rupert's case, he was undoubtedly a sort of a genius. He was a fidget, as someone said. He couldn't sit still. He doesn't like words. He likes headlines. He has tremendous flair for a gamble. I mean, the gambles he's taken, the money he's lost. Mm. But he's ability to take a decision, which I saw at close quarters, was often phenomenal. And actually, when things are going well, he's a very good man to work for. because there were never any. Nothing went to a committee. Nothing ever went to a meeting.
He was a decider.
He just decided.
Yeah, he made decisions.
And he fired people and he hired them and he fired them and he hired them. It was often difficult. He also was a very emotional man. I mean, when Harry was there, I talked to Harry about his time. He had an awful time with Rupert because Rupert really wanted to edit the paper. When Rupert had him, which was, well, the beginning of the 70s, I mean, when Harry was there, it was Rupert was still young and he was terribly pleased to have the Times. He was just over the moon to have bought the Times. By the time I'm talking about the Sunday Times, he was doing very well. He was buying into America. His mind was always on other things, and he got on with Andrew very well. So it was at that time, it was a good relationship.
What newspaper proprietors other than Rupert have impressed you, and have any knock? I mean, I'm thinking as well as the kind of modern breed of proprietor, someone like Evgeny Lebedev. I mean, clearly, as you've just said, you know, all proprietors are in it for something, but he just seems to be a, you know, I don't want to focus on him, but a bit of a dandy and wants to be kind of meet Hollywood celebs, and that's his reason for running the Standard as well as the occasional thing. But, you know, do you ever kind of look back fondly to, you know, the proprietors like Robert Maxwell and Conrad Black? You know, they were out and out crooks, but at least you knew what they were there for.
No, because they were out and out crooks.
Exactly.
I mean,
yeah.
I can't.
Wrong-uns.
Those characters, they were kind of spivs. And they were there, wield power. They loved the fact they had power over journalists who are very powerful people. I mean, journalists are powerful people. And they exude an aura of influence and presence and being where it's at. These nouveau riche proprietors just want to dust themselves with, in my view. The old ones who would have gone, I mean, the famous Thompson family. I mean, God knows why they wanted to be proprietors. But anyway, they did. But they were completely hands-off. They were totally hands-off. And that was fine, provided the money was being made. But when Roy Thompson bought the Times in, whenever it was, 64, I mean, it was losing $250,000 a year, which in those days was big money. He did things to the Times that Rupert never did. And, I mean, great chunks of the Times resigned. The famous Black Swan letter, when the senior, when it was 20 people on the paper, signed this letter protesting about what Roy Thompson had done to the Times. People forget that. I mean, he was a grand old man by the time he got to the end. But, I mean, it's difficult. Every single proprietor is different. Some of them have strengths. Most of them have weaknesses. All I know is that as against countries where governments run newspapers, give me the British system any day.
This is imperfect, but it's... less terrible than the other systems, as it were.
It's plural.
Yeah.
It's plural. It means you've got a choice. I mean, there was a time in the 70s when it was a genuine risk, if Maxwell hadn't bought the Mirror, that it was just possible that every British national newspaper would have been conservative. That would have been a really bad thing. And when I became a journalist, there were 7 national papers. There are now 8. I mean, it's amazing the continuity of this industry.
It is. It's amazing how it even carries on, given the losses that it makes.
And they've always made losses. And the title of my book was The Market for Glory. I mean, the Market for Glory is a very potent market. It dominates racehorses, West End musicals and newspapers. People will lose vast amounts of money, and mistresses. They lose vast amounts of money on these things, happily, as long as they get the glory.
So just back to your time at the Sunday Times then. How long were you there for as a columnist, and how long did you work there for?
I was at the Sunday Times, from about 85 through to 89... when Rupert then said, "Do I want to edit the Times?" I mean, they were pretty hectic times at Wapping, and Rupert was approaching serious financial difficulties, and the Independent then had started and was making huge inroads into the Times.
Is that Andreas Whittam Smith?
That was a really successful operation, and I almost joined him when he founded it, and had long talks with him about it, and I just thought, I'm safe at the Sunday Times. No, I'm not going to move. Then I end up as his competitor. We were on good terms.
Was that time to be an editor? Were you excited that you could be an editor for a paper that had left its troubles? You know, when you were at the Standard, you were distracted by all kinds of trouble, as it were. Did you think that this is my chance to be a kind of full-time editor?
At the time?
Yes.
Yes. Oh, I mean, there was no argument there. I mean, the Times was. I mean, Charlie was a good man. He's a great editor, Charlie Wilson. But I mean, the paper had gone right down market. It was like the Daily Mail, and it was being taken to the cleaners by the Independent. I mean, Andrews said to me rather proudly once, he said, the Independent now, the paper that bishops write letters to.
It's interesting now, given the current plight of the Independent. I mean, don't get me wrong, Lebedev's stopped it hemorrhaging money, but you know, as you've just said then, it was the paper of record when it started.
Andrews was really first class. He was an editor and a businessman. He set it up. He staffed it brilliantly. He ran it very well. And the Times was being taken to the cleaners.
So you felt on the back foot as editor?
And that was why Rupert asked me to edit, I think. I mean, I never got to the bottom of it. But anyway, that's why he did. I said to him, Rupert, these relationships tend to end in tears. You know, what is your requirement? He said, I've got to stop the Independent. Yeah, I've got to stop the Independent. It's clearly gone too far down market. I think you're the person to take back up market. I want to get some new writers. I want you to see off the Independent.
In a one-line brief, that was it. See off the Independent.
Yeah.
So did you feel energised by the opportunity at that point? Because you're then editor of the Times. You can hire, you can fire, you can put people in that you respect and get off people who you think are doing it down. It must be quite an exciting opportunity, really, to kind of make your vision for what the paper should be real.
I had a specific remit. I had no money, but I had a specific remit. We were in Wapping. Costs were fairly low at that point. I then discovered that costs were being loaded onto the Times to make the Sun look good. But, I mean, that was a different matter. And you know, we really had to recast the Times. And it was a major undertaking. It was exhausting. It was fun.
Long hours?
You just worked all the time. And that was. I mean, I just think editing a newspaper is the most exhilarating thing any journalist can do. I really do. But it's quite different from writing. It's exhilarating. I won't put it another way.
Did you write a column at the same time?
Oh, Lord, no.
Didn't have time, or no. Was that deliberate?
You read the occasional leader. I mean, the leaders mattered to me, and I felt Times leaders needed, in some sense, re-establishing. I mean, you know, we had good leader writers, and I brought in new columnists and so on. Peter Riddle and Anatole Kolecki and people like that came from the FT and so on. We were on raiding parties. It was a big operation. It was great fun, but I mean, about sort of 9 months in, Rupert hit potential bankruptcy. And there was no way that didn't impact on the papers. He was just close to disaster. I mean, he'd seen Bond and Holmes of Court, these other Australian businessmen who'd got sort of too big for their boots, all went under. He was heavily overborrowed. He was buying into 20th Century Fox. He was buying into these big American companies. He was acquiring things fanatically. He almost bought the FT. And he was crazy. Rupert, you asked me about Rupert Murdoch. Rupert Murdoch was a hopeless manager. He was a brilliant dealer.
Mm.
And he couldn't stop doing deals. And nobody knew how exposed he was because these people didn't reveal how exposed they were. But, I mean, the shit hit the fan. And he was going around begging for money. And he turned around and people like the Times said, I want you to take 10% out of your costs and I want you to double your cover price. Well, that was just devastating in those days. And so I said, well, you know, we're fighting the Independent. Going to double our cover price and lose 10% of the staff.
But I was going to say, doubling the cover price, that's simple economics, wouldn't double the revenue because you're going to get a loss in readers who won't pay the increased price.
It was desperate measures. I mean, it wasn't quite doubling, but it was effectively doubling. It was a very tough period, and we did take a sort of hit on that.
How close do you think he came to teetering to the edge?
I haven't read the relevant biographies very closely, but he came very close.
Mm.
He came very close. And indeed, in many ways, it was Rupert at his best because he went round. I mean, the others just left it to their bankers and their agent. Rupert went round personally with one assistant to every one of the 60 or 70 banks who owed him money, he owed money to, and pleaded with them. That took some doing.
I bet. Genuine entrepreneurial pluck.
He said to me afterwards, I'll never, ever, ever use a bank again. But he pulled through, but it really was. I mean, all the papers at Wapping had a very tough time then. And it was just a difficult period to be an editor.
And did that change something in you then? Did you start to think about moving on? Because you were only there for about 2 years, weren't you?
I was there about two and a half years. Yep. I mean, yes. I mean, it was. I mean, my original deal with him was, you know, when he asked me to see off the Independent, I said, look, Rupert, I said, you've got to leave me alone for 2 years. I mean, I want 2 years of non-intervention. And
he agreed to that.
Rupert's word wasn't worth it. What the area was right was stagnated, but I mean, it meant something to me.
He notionally agreed then.
Yes, and yeah. I said after that, you know, you do with me what you will. But I mean, that's what I really want. I just don't want this to be I didn't want it to be just a mess.
You were kind of a fatalist, even at that point, or a realist, you could say, because you knew it was you were going to be fired at some point, even going in.
Well,
that's the fate of all editors, I suppose.
Yes, yeah, no, I'm a total realist. But I always wanted to write a column for the Times. Curious, that really had been always been for a long while. I'd always thought the Times was the best place to write a column, and in fact, I think one of the things I said to Rupert and also to Andrew Knight, who was then his aide in this endeavour. I want to make the Times a paper I want to write a column for. I'd be honoured. And at that stage, I wouldn't write. I mean, I think they'd offer me a column, and I'd said no before. So I'd like to make the Times the kind of paper I'd be proud to write a column for. That was my personal test. And I think I did that. But the circulation, it was not doing well. The money was appalling. Everything was kind of a mess. And Rupert characteristically thought, I think I really want Paul Dacre to edit the Times. I keep saying that. And that's what he tried to do. And it was a close-run thing.
Yeah, I was going to say. Mm. And did Paul have a formidable reputation then as he does now?
He had the reputation of being David English's successor. Mm. And Rupert was obsessed with David English. He thought David English was one of the greatest editors. And he longed to have David English working for him. But he longed to run the Mail and have David English working for him there. So Dacre was sort of English's
sidekick,
apostle on earth.
Yeah,
yes. I mean, English was a kind of a genius. Dacre, I don't think, was a genius, but he ran the Daily Mail to the formula, and it was very successful, no doubt about it. And Rupert, having done that with Charlie, when you had, you know, the editors of the Times swung. You had Douglas Hume, who Rupert didn't touch because he was ill. Charles was very lucky in that sense. Mm. Terrible mess with Harry Evans. In comes Charles Wilson, takes it down market, doesn't work. The Independent comes in to prove that. I see off the Independent, which ultimately we really did. And then he thinks, now I want to be more like the Daily Mail. Typical Rupert. He falls in love. And it was great being close to Rupert. I mean, my wife loved it, and he liked her, and we used to visit them in America and so on.
Are you still friends with him now?
No.
What was your last day at the Times like then? Were you, was it a kind of cordial moving on? Had you already worked out what was next? Or was there a kind of... I mean, I've known quite a few editors that have worked for Rupert, and sometimes they've been sacked in a quite unpleasant way, and others have said, oh, yeah, it came to an end and we both knew it was an end and we've moved on. Very much
the latter. I mean, thank you very much, and you've done what I want you to do. It was all reasonably cordial. And he said, you know, do you want to write a column? And I said, yeah, I'd love to write a column. So you see, well, you can keep your contract and go and write in column. As simple as that. The one thing that was really a bitter dispute was over Dacre. Mm. And I just said, I think if you get Paul to edit the Times, you'll undo everything I've done. And you've got a deputy editor in Peter Stollart. I mean, I really feel, you know, you've got no excuse for not giving him the editorship.
And he subsequently proved to be a great editor, of course.
And he did. It worked. But, I mean, of course, then what happened was the immediate thing he did was he slashed the price by half.
It's quite commercial.
And, no, I mean, Rupert did.
Yes.
I mean, Peter persuaded him to, whereupon the circulation surged. I was a little bitter about that. But, I mean, frankly, come on. To have edited the Times is just a wonderful thing to have done as a journalist. I've got no complaints at all.
And I mean, do you still consider yourself a journalist? Because you obviously clearly have got a portfolio career, as it were. You've mentioned already that you had, you know, you joined the Railways Board. Mm. You became chair of the National Trust for many years, having been a bit of a critic of them for many years. Was that something that when you left the Times that you wanted to increase that kind of diversity of what you were at your appointments?
I never, ever thought I wasn't a journalist. I mean, if anyone asks me where I am, I'm a journalist. I'm almost shocked by your question. Absolutely. I'm on the staff of The Guardian, very happily so. I think that really, in many ways, I mean, many of my contemporaries have gone on to do something else, and many of them, you know, sort of half think you stay a journalist at this age, and what on earth are you up to? I just can't imagine being anything else. I really can't. It doesn't cross my scanner.
Have you ever viewed it as work, or has it always been a lifestyle? Has this been your calling?
I would have said it was my life. I can't imagine not being a journalist. I'm not going into the office occasionally. I love the smell of a newspaper. I mean, even as antiseptic a paper as The Guardian, I just like going into the office, which I try and do every fortnight or so. I go to conference every fortnight. I go into the Standard occasionally. I write for the Standard. It is the most exhilarating profession I can imagine. All the things I'm interested in, politics, the arts, culture, London, it's provided me an outlet for my views on. I've been able to write books. I've been able to joined boards. I don't anymore. But I mean, all that sort of thing you can do. I do feel journalists do broaden their horizon by doing other things. I really do. But I also feel that there has to be an absolute Chinese wall. And I've never, ever written about a subject that I'm also involved in professionally or in any other way. When I was in the railways for 10 years, I never read a single article about railways. It was mortifying, but I didn't. And I feel that very strongly. I was always shocked by William Rees Mogg, who was an old timer columnist who wrote for the Times and shamelessly promoted his other interests, particularly General Electric. I mean, it was outrageous. I thought. I mean, I feel quite moralistic about journalism.
How do you feel about the plight of journalism currently? I mean, do you feel sorry for someone starting out in journalism now? Because in a sense, it's easier, isn't it? You've got Twitter and LinkedIn and blogging, and it's easier to get your name out there. But there are so fewer positions available, and the competition is incredibly intense. And also, there's no job security whatsoever in journalism these days. Would you agree?
Well, I don't know. Journalism has been very good to me. I spent 15 years at the Times, and then I was poached by the Guardian, and that was a big decision because I was very much part of the Times. I mean, I'd edited, I'd written a column for it, I'd been trained by it. I was a total Times person, and it was only being of a certain age and wanting to give myself a kick up the seat of the pants that made me move. And I'm very glad I did. I'm often asked your question by young people who want to go into the press. I go and talk to journalism schools and so on. And the professors always say to me, please don't depress them too much. And I say, I'm not going to. I mean, in the first place, I bet you anything. I always quote two statistics. One is that more quality newspapers are being sold and bought in Britain today than when I became a journalist. Nobody believes it. But the fact, and there are more of them, there's the Independent, plus the FT's come big and the Guardian's come national. I mean, all these things have happened in my career in journalism. And people buy them. Now, they aren't buying them like they were in 2000. No question about that. You can't argue about that. But you could argue that the whopping revolution in the 80s led to a surge in newspaper bulk. I mean, newspapers went from being sort of 6 pages to being 60 pages. I mean, just extraordinary. No one remembers this. Thousands of journalists were hired to write newspapers as a result of Whopping. Whopping, and I'll say this for Rupert, Whopping was the best thing that ever happened to this industry. Mm. Newspapers in America were just killed at that time. Two in New York, three in New York. I mean, they just wiped out. In Britain, we have more newspapers now than then. Now, I mean, that's the one thing. Secondly, as a result, there are more words written, there are more journalists employed. All these things are the case now than was the case when I became a journalist. So I just don't buy into this gloom thing. It's a very different profession. It's highly digitalized. I mean, all the things are different. They're huge threats. I find native advertising, as it's called, an advertorial, and all these dodgy deals that every paper's doing really worry me. I'm a bit of an ethicist about this.
No, I agree with you. There's a real blurring of the lines.
A lot of blurring lines. Yeah, it really is. But the jobs are there. People are getting employed. Too many people are being trained as journalists. There's no doubt about that. And that wasn't the case before. So it's like acting. People are coming out of journalism schools in their thousands, and they, if they're lucky, they're going to PR. I don't know. I mean, the Guardian employs, God knows how many hundreds of people now. All right, it's not making money, but they never did. It is, as you say, less secure. There's no doubt about it. Many people are freelance. The competition's intense. Pay is not very good. I don't know. I mean, all I can say is that, there now must be a dozen columnists on The Guardian, and they sure as hell weren't when I joined The Guardian, when I read The Guardian as a student.
Well, not just a dozen columnists in print, but of course they've got commenters free, and there's hundreds of columnists. Mm. Providing you're reasonably engaging as a writer, and you've got a good point of view, you can basically get on commenters free.
This is not a bad profession to be in. It never has been, and in Britain it is a particularly good one. You're in a city like London, which is a world capital. You're in the English speaking capital of the world, in Parche, New York, but the industry in London is much more flourishing than it is in New York. It is curiously supported by this strange hinterland, which is made up of the digital media, made up of the lecture circuit. It's made up of events in London. It's made up of book writing, which is as vigorous as ever. Magazines aren't what they were, but there are plenty of magazines. Then there are things like literary festivals. The world of the cultivated Londoner, the world of the London intelligentsia, easy to ridicule. is nonetheless far more fruitful and active than it's ever been before. So although it's easy to think that things aren't as good as they used to be in the good old days, I just don't buy into it.
What's next for you? Final question.
I'm always writing a book. I'm usually writing two.
How many books have you written so far?
I don't know, about 15 or 16.
It's a lot, yeah. It's a lot, isn't it?
I try and write one on politics, and then one on architecture or the environment, which is my other sort of love, any one time. So that's always on the ball. And I work for The Guardian and the Evening Standard, and I'm very happy doing it. I do it till I drop.
Simon, I feel like we've only covered about half the things that we should do. I had tons of questions that I'd like to ask, but unfortunately we have run out of metaphorical tape, so it just remains for me to say thank you ever so much for your time. I've learnt a huge amount.
Thank you.
A Big Things Media production. Big Things!